All right, I guess we can get going. To start off with, are there any questions, remarks, anything with the projects, in particular the one that we just graded? Anything you want to know? Let me get out the chat. No, if that's not the case, then I can just start with the material. And so after looking at your deliveries, so I mean, I have to say, all in all, you did a very good job. So I'm quite pleased with at least the projects that I graded. So there are some things that would probably prevent you from, you know, really having that reproducible and sort of high quality machine learning environment that you would need in a more professional setting. And even if it's a research project, you know, you want to make sure that you have a good way to configure your scripts, to store your models in a good way, to have a bit of control over your work, that is to say. So today we'll look at two main topics. The first one is a little bit around, okay, so once you have your model, what then? How do you sort of, in a more professional setting, how do you manage models and all this? And I think this will come in handy for sure once you are in an industry setting, but I think it will also be very helpful in sort of bigger university and research projects. Then we'll talk a little bit about, you know, configuring things, and I'll show you a few things that you might want to look at if you, for the second project, chose to look at the GYM project. And then we'll hopefully have a little bit of time left towards the end to look at, yeah, data storage, APIs, and these kind of things. Are there any questions to those topics before we get started? No. Okay, then I'll share my screen. This guy hopefully is the right one. And I'll move a few things out of the way. And where's my chat? Okay. Good. So let's get going. So, you know, a lot of you had in your delivery, you had a bunch of different models that you made. And to talk a little bit about this, let's load some data in Pandas. And then let's make a model and evaluate it. So we need some metrics. And then we use the R squared score and the mean squared error. From the model selection, split, and then we make a very simple decision tree model. And then we'll use, yeah, let's do it step by step. So If you don't know this data set, it's actually a quite interesting one. I'll just drop in a URL here. This is the data set about wine quality. So they did a chemical analysis on red wines. You have acidity there, and I can show you the data set. So it's around 1,600 red wines, and you have different chemical properties, acidity, citric acid, sugar, chlorides, and so on. And then you have a quality score, and that quality score is sort of a voted score from a bunch of wine experts. And the question is, can you predict the score given the chemical properties? And there's, of course, all kinds of things wrong with this kind of approach because quality is to a large degree something subjective. So we heard last time about labeling noise. So you would assume that there's quite a bit of labeling noise in here, yet we only have one quality score. So it would be kind of interesting to see what is the individual's sort of error in this. So if you look at just look at the quality score, right? So first of all, we'll see that the 3 and 4 and 8 is almost never used. So there you already see that a lot of averaging is going on here. It's a highly unbalanced data set also. So there's all kind of problems with this. But it's a fun exercise, and it will serve us well as a as an example on how to make a model, and then do a bit of housekeeping on that model. And this is really what we want. So let's get the labels out of this. So the quality is our target, our labels. Note that this pop is actually modifying, so df then now doesn't contain quality anymore. Now we do our usual, so we make a training data set, test data set, test split. With 30% test data. So now we need some metadata, and this is what many of you did in your deliveries. So you had a bunch of metadata or parameters. We use the depth and the minimum number of examples in the leaf nodes for this. For a different model, probably those would look differently. So let's say we have a depth of 3, and we want at least 10 examples in a leaf node. And now, instead of just steaming ahead and training and testing our model, what we'll do is we'll use a package called MLflow. To do a bit of bookkeeping for us. So the entry point into MLflow is a MLflow run. We can give it a name. And then we do our model building in here. So the model shall be a decision tree regressor with max depth given by our depth parameter here, and min samples leaf is the min leaf parameter. We fit the model to our training data. And now what we do, we tell MLflow, okay, keep track of my parameters. I can either register a single parameter or multiple parameters, giving it a dictionary with the parameter names, so depth. And then leaf. So this basically now keeps track of the parameters. Now I evaluate my model. So my predictions shall be model.predict on my test data. And you know, of course, now we need to be a bit careful because the performance now will vary from run to run because we do a random split here. So to make this completely reproducible, you would probably want a kind of random seed in here, and then also keep track of the random seed in the with the parameters. But okay. So now that I have my predictions, I can log my metrics on the model, and let's call this R squared, and that's of course our R squared score that we imported from scikit-learn, and test labels and prediction, and then we can log our mean squared error with Y test and predictions. And then I log my model. So this is basically saying, okay, store this model with some name and with the register model name. So by default, this would store the model and those logs on hard disk, just in a YAML file. We'll see a bit about them in a second. But what I want here is store it actually in a database. So SQLite is a database that basically lives on your hard disk. But it's a little bit more structured than just having it in a plain file. Now I can run this. Okay. So now a bunch of things happen. So it registered the decision tree model, created a version one of it, and in here we have a new folder called ML runs. That will have stored my tree run. Hopefully, yeah. Here's my model. And I also have my model's database. So what I can do now is in a console, run in a console MLflow UI. And I'll do that in a invisible to you window. But when I run this command, I get a URI. So in here, I now see my test run, my tree run that I just completed now from my IPython kernel. Depth three, and these, so these are the model parameters and these are the metrics. So if I now run this again with a different set of metrics, let's say depth of 5 and the 20, minimum of 20 examples in my leaf nodes, and rerun this. So this warning, I don't know really what this is. I think it's something about MLflow not playing nicely with the IPython version that I have. But ignore those for now. But then I will have here the second run, just 2 minutes after, with my new parameters and updated metrics. So, and this is a very nice way to keep track of, you know, the models that you made, the parameters, the metrics, and so on. So especially if you, you know, have a bigger project where you try out a lot of different things, try different parameters, this can be extremely helpful. And then any of those models, so now we have a version 2 of that model, we can of course retrieve that by telling retrieved model, by telling MLflow to load a model. And I give it what it calls a model URI. And this is basically just saying models. And then it wants the name of the model. So it's going to be decision tree model. And then the version. So depending now, at the first time I created version 1, now version 2. So whichever version of this model I want. Okay. Okay. So this didn't work out. But anyway, so usually you should be able to see all the versions of your model, and you can retrieve it. And then I can actually tell my retrieved model. So this is now a loaded model. And I can ask it to, you know, just like a normal scikit-learn model, predict on my X test, for example, and I get my predictions. Okay. So this is MLflow, and of course, you know, if you think about a applied setting where you collaborate with colleagues or work together with other departments in a company, or even, you know, in a research project, and you want to keep track of who made what model, when, with which parameters, what was the metric, and so on. This is, of course, super helpful. One little caveat here is that, of course, you need to make sure that everybody uses the same data. And here really comes into play all what we talked about pipelines, and, you know, putting everything together into one pipeline, so that the data wrangling will also be reproducible, right? So if you do, for example, one hot encoding and so on, this is also required here to be inside the model if you want to use this to keep track of your work and keep it reproducible. Do you have any questions or comments or remarks to that? Is this something that you see that would be useful in your studies or later work?
Does this library cover other things than just sklearn?
Yes, actually, it covers a lot of different stuff. So if you go to the MLflow, so the backends, I think we need to go to the docs. It's a while since I since I worked with this, but you know, it has for sure the standard. No, so I don't find it here. But so it for sure has the standard sort of scikit-learn, stats models, Spark, Torch, TensorFlow, so all the standard frameworks that it supports, which also makes it nice. So, you know, this way you can compare performances very easily across frameworks and so on. Of course, you know, it's also flexible in that, you know, your metric here could be easily something like utility. So that makes it very nice to work with. Good. Does anyone see issues with this? Now, so if we just look at this is a little bit what I said before. Of course, one needs to take these scores with a grain of salt. If I just do another train test split here, right? Now it's really getting overwhelming with these errors. I need to get rid of this. But don't worry about them. It's just a warning. It's not gonna, you know, destroy anything. But now we run it with the same parameters. And now in my model repository, I have another version of this model with the same meta parameters, but with a different mean square and a different R square, right? And this is just a new train test split. So of course, just, you know, one number never really tells the full story. And especially in you know, so it's of course not a super huge improvement going from 277 to 29. In R squared, but still, it's, you know, so one needs to be a bit careful just looking at one number. But that's that. But still, so once you know, some of you had a dozen or so models in their delivery, and then it might actually make sense to use something like this. But then also, I mean, it's easy to get overboard with frameworks and so on. But I thought I mentioned this. Good. Any more questions to this? No. Good. So then I don't know how many has any of you used this Fairness Gym? Had a look at this. You can maybe just raise your hand, or don't know how this works well in. Yeah, okay. So for those who haven't made, and maybe you got surprised by one thing that they do a lot in this Fairness Gym, at least they use they use a package called Atter. Okay, now this is getting very annoying. Let me restart the kernel here because we don't need the stuff from above. Okay, so clearly ML floated something funny to my IPython kernel. Okay, so they use this Atter, and a problem that it solves is really around ease of writing classes and attributes in particular. I mean, this is really what this is about, of course. And it removes boilerplate. So if you have a class, let's say it's my banker class, and it has something like a model, or even, you know, you do a init self model and let's say interest rate, interest just, you know, some of you got confused with that. So in the assignment, there was the difference between monthly interest and so the duration of the loan was in months, right? So interest, maybe you want something like monthly M interest or so, just to make this clear, because some of your interests were very high. And of course, if you loan money at a 30% interest rate, it's hard to lose money on this. But anyway, and maybe you want a default here, I don't know, 0.5% yearly, you know, this would be now yearly. And then you do something like model equal model self, okay, self, see, I already made a mistake, self.model, self.interest equal interest. And this is, you know, so this init function, the self, it's not very readable what kind of attributes my class will have. So this atter class is coming to our help. So what you first need to do is say, you decorate this class with this atter.s decorator. Everybody knows what decorators are. Does anyone want me to explain what those do? Raise your hand if you want an explanation. Okay, then it's very clear to everybody. So I decorate my class with this. And now I can basically write something like model equal trip and interest equal and now, if I instantiate my banker with, okay, some model, none, and some interest, this will work out of the box. And I can even do things like giving defaults here. So then I can leave out this guy. But I cannot say my banker. My banker. Okay. Yeah. We're not interested in bread making. All right, so I cannot do this because it generated an init function for me that expects those two. And the sort of the theory is that this is you know, much easier to use and much more readable, right? So Python 3.9 has this concept of data classes which do something similar, but this is way more powerful because you can also give it a function that it uses to make new instances of this class and so on. So it's more than just generating an init function. But you can also have converters. So for example, if you want anything coming in to be converted to an int, you can have checkers that sort of make sure that you know, your arguments are sane. So you can make sure that, I don't know, the interest rate is bigger than zero or something like this. So this is extremely helpful. And I hope this clears up a little bit this whole use of utter and trip in this package. So you will see a lot of those if you use the gym. And I thought, you know, the first time I saw this, I got confused. So I thought it would be a good idea to clear that up a little bit. Okay, but that's all I wanted to say about this atter. So it has a very good documentation also. So if you have you know, if you want to dive more deeply into this, it will make your code cleaner and easier to understand and less error prone as well. So if there are no more questions, we'll cover one more thing, which also is super important, especially if you work together with people. It's testing. So let's say I have a test method that, of course, takes x and y data, and then calls self.model.fit x, y, return self, something like this. Right. So this probably looks a little bit like the code that you wrote. But now, so in general, you know, it's always good to test your code. There are, of course, limits to something like a machine learning model, to really test that. You know, you could write some tests that says, well, if I for a regression model always predict the average, right? So let's go back to the wine data. If I always predict what would be the average, something like five and a half maybe. So if I always predict 5.5 as a baseline model, then whatever I do should be performing better. So this I could write as a test. And Python has a like huge framework for writing these kind of tests. And it's especially good for writing more tests that check the function of the code. And that really has huge advantages. So if you write a bunch of battery of tests for your code, and you know that this is sort of the expected behavior, then whenever you modify your code and you know, change something around, you can rerun those tests just to make sure that whatever you introduce now doesn't break the underlying assumptions that you have. And I'll show you real quick. So unit test is the Python package that does a lot of this magic. And especially if you have things like, you know, our model here, that's a class, that's something that should have a fit function and so on. And working with these kind of external objects, it's always a little bit awkward. And also there, unit test has a very good module that's called mock, which basically makes dummy objects that you can use that way without really functioning. But I can use those dummy objects to make sure my code does the right thing. And I'll show you how that goes in a second. So my banker test is a unit test dot test case. So you want to test something, you make a new class that, you know, usually one class that you write gets one test class. And in that test class, we have a bunch of test functions. You can do some setup in here and a lot of different, so there are a lot of functionalities, but most of the time you will only need to write this test underscore something. And, you know, let's leave it at that for now. And then actually you can call in your script unittest.main, and that will run all the tests, but it will break my notebook. So I need to give it two extra arguments. So I have to tell it the arguments of my script because I'm not running a script. And I need to say, please don't exit, because else it will crash my Python kernel potentially. Well, and then what it does, it takes all my test cases. So this one test, so it will automatically discover all subclasses of this test case and run all the tests. So that is a very nice, now very little code that you need to write to get this functionality. And even if you have like multiple test classes and multiple files, it's usually very good at picking those up and running those. So let's say, you know, we want to just make sure that this fit function calls model fit at some point, because in, you know, some of the students' code, it did not. So let's make sure that this happens. So I need a model class, and I can make a mock model very easily. As a subclass of unit test dot, as an instance of unit test dot mock dot mock. Then I can say, make a banker with my mock model. And then I can call banker.fit. So this will now work just fine. X, Y. So I just give it two strings that read X and Y. And then I can say, well, mock model. So the fit function assert that this has been called with the arguments X and Y. Typo this is a typo that I intended to do, because this now will give me an error, right? My banker has no attribute fit.
You wrote my baker.
Thank you. I would have taken a long time to, but right. So here already we have an error, but okay. So now my test failed because of this typo, right? So instead of X, U. So expected call. So, and this is very verbose, right? Expected call not found. Expected fit X U, actual fit X Y. Right. So if I fix this now, and if I leave this in my code, I forever know that this calls the fit method with the right parameters. So this is extremely powerful, and I really, really suggest you consider whenever you do a bigger project to at least write a few consistency tests, because we all know how it goes. Hours before you have to submit, something doesn't work, you broke something, you have no idea what you did wrong, so you have to roll back. And unit tests usually help you avoid some of the most obvious things, at least. So another very warm suggestion to consider this. Any questions to that? I mean, there's this whole philosophy behind test-driven development that you should first write your unit test before you write code. I'm not a religious follower of this, but if you want to read more about this, there's a very good book here, Clean Code, or The Clean Code. So there are two books, Clean Code and Clean Code by Robert Martin. So very well worth looking into this. Also, Robert Martin has a few good talks on YouTube, so you should check them out. Anyway, so let's move on. One other thing that I saw a lot of you did is magic numbers in your code. And that can be sometimes unavoidable, but so often it is a better idea to make, the interest rate or things like this, make this not baked into the code, but take it as a parameter. So when you run your Python script, you actually, use this as a parameter. And also there, Python really has you covered. So let's be a bit tidy here. Command line arguments. So this is basically, you would call your Python script with some, let's say, I want to call my script like, so something like test lending.py --  interest 0.05 or something like this, right? Or maybe --model tree And how do we do this? Well, there's an excellent, and this is all built in ArcPass, unit test, this is all built in to core Python. So what you do is you make your argument parser. And you can even give it a description of the program. So one line description of my program. And this will already do a lot. So if you call your code, and now we need to do this again because we're in a IPython environment, we need to do this a little bit the manual way. So in your code, you would do something like if, you know, normally just if name equal main, parser dot parse args, like that. Now we need to be a bit more verbose, so we need to say parse args, and we need to tell it, because again, I'm in an IPython notebook, Jupyter notebook, so I need to tell it how the arguments look. And even again, exceptions. Just this one liner gives me already a help function, and it's a usage like this, and IPython kernel launcher. That's now the name of the script. But normally, it will actually figure out what the name of the script is. Take your one line description. So this is already a lot of benefits that you get just from this one line of code. But now I can actually tell it to say, parser dot add argument. And I can call it dash dash interest. Right, and now if I run this, Jesus, okay. Okay, so that's my mistake. Right, so now I have a namespace here, and then I can access this with dot interest. And even if I parse now the empty arguments. No, actually need to give it interest, right? But that's good. That is ArcPass, and again, so this has a lot. So if you go to the ArcPass documentation, there's a lot going on. You know, you can give it arguments without a name, flags, complex actions. So this is very, very, very thorough. So you don't need to use everything. But you know, instead of having a fixed magic number in your script, often it's much better to you know, give it the interest or something like this in a more flexible way in a command line argument. Okay, so we're almost at an end of our of our little tour. So if you have no more questions to the command line arguments or things like this, then we can attack the last thing I wanted to talk about. Now, so no questions, no. Good. Then the last thing I was saying, you know, so what if I want to create, so this all sounds nice and good, but maybe I have, different kinds of models. So I want to do something like this model tree, and then I want to go sort of from a string to a Python class, and that can be a bit tricky. So I thought I'd give you at least some idea, and even though this is not a Python programming course, but I think some of those basics they can be very helpful. So a simple way to get this model is let's give it a header. Creating a model. So of course a very easy thing to do is from. So if I have my banker again, I can do something like let's say I have just one model. So logistic regression. Then I can actually tell this, well, my model shall be give it a factory, and this basically just wants a function that will create the type for you. So here I can actually say logistic regression, and now if I'm making my banker, will have that guy as a model. So this is the way of having one fixed model, but then maybe you want to generate this from a string or something. And there actually it is very useful to know something that's called the factory pattern. So what you do. As you make a function that's a model factory and get some extra arguments that I don't care about. And now one thing I could do is something like if model name equal let's say logistic. I return logistic regression args. So then I can say model factory, logistic regression, logistic, and I don't know, I can give it the regularization parameter, and it will create this for me. And then if I just call this with some typo, it will return none. This is not too bad, but I might want to be warned about this. And this gets very tedious if I basically do the same thing over and over. Let's say I have a tree model here also, and another one, right? So then I have a lot of if equal return. So Python doesn't have a select case statement, but what I can actually do is I can make a dictionary, and now this will just have the logistic regression, but this could have many, many entries. And then I can say model class equal classes.get model name and say if model return F model, sorry, model class, because you know this get will return none if the model name is not in my dictionary. And then I can return my model class with, again, those args. And this will, you know, work just as advertised. I can even go one step further than here, and I can say else raise not implemented error. And even give it some, you know, model class model name unknown. And since, you know, we are nice, we can say possible models are classes.keys. So this then will, you know, if I say tree, and I can, you know, even give it a depth equal 5. This will then raise this error and give me a nice error message. Class tree unknown, possible models are. Logistic. So this is a very neat trick to, you know, then you can store the model name in a configuration file or give it as a script parameter to your script, and you know, then get, you know, the right class or the error. Yes, any questions to that? So that's called the model, the factory pattern, and there are some sort of standard programming patterns that can be extremely useful to at least, you know of them, because often if you want to, you know, code something up and you get stuck somewhere, very often there are these standard patterns that really help. So of course, you know, in upcoming deliveries, you don't need to, you know, use all of this, but I thought it might be useful to know of it, especially, you know, as you hopefully progress and get more professional in programming as well, this will be more and more expected of you. All right. So last, actually kind of the last, let's talk about, so what if you say, yeah, you know, Dirk, this whole command line arguments, I see it, but maybe, you know, I want to deliver something that is kind of pre-configured, so I then need to tell people sort of what command line arguments to run. I don't like that so much. There is a million ways to make configuration files, but one very common is YAML, and you maybe, if you have keen eyes, remember in our MLflow models here we have this conda.yaml, and that's a file in that format. It's, YAML stands for yet another markup language, because there are so many different ways to do this. But you know, let's look very shortly at YAML, and that's basically because it's, you know, plays very nicely with Python. What will happen basically is if you have a file, if you have a YAML file like this, this sort of key colon. So this will, you can probably already guess. So this will be parsed into a dictionary. And this is, you know, a list. So this will be passed actually into a list. And then this list here again contains a dictionary with a list as the value. So this is, you know, much more human readable than other markup languages, but still easy to parse and to understand how this will look in Python. So this can be very, very useful if you want to, you know, make a configuration that, that your script then will read and set parameters and so on. Much, much better to have a generic script and a configuration file that then sets these magic numbers than have a lot of magic numbers in your code. And it's very easy to use. YAML, so this you need to install. It's not part of core Python. And it's really as easy as saying YAML.foolload. This fool is needed because there were some security concerns with some versions of YAML. So there are now different levels of, yeah. So don't worry too much about this. And you know, so we could easily say, okay, C is 0.75, some regularization parameter. We can say our interest is 0.06. Then something else, some list. You can also just write it as, you know, Python lists, that works. This other format of list also, you can match and mix them. This is a list. And so this will be parsed into Python. And see here also sort of this is parsed into floats, this is parsed into integers, so this is extremely powerful. And you could even go one step further. So let's say we make a evaluator function to evaluate your models, class evaluator. And I can inherit from YAML object. And I need to give it a tag. That looks a bit like this. We'll see how that works. And I guess you can already guess what will happen here. So I can say my interest is some attribute and my folds. So let's say I want to do some sort of cross validation, and this is the folds of my validator, another attribute. And I could here parse that, make sure that this is an integer bigger than 2 or bigger equal than 2. And I could make sure that this is a float bigger than 0 or something like this. But let's leave it like this for now. And then I can just say again, YAML.foolload. I'm writing strings now, but of course, so this will be your file, your YAML file that you then read, right? So didn't explicitly say so, but and now I can write evaluator interest 0.06 and folds equal 10. Okay. Could not determine. Okay. Here we go. All right, so this will parse nicely. Now I just made a list. Doesn't need to have that, but folds. Right, so I don't even have to you know, pass this into these dictionaries and lists. I can pass this straight into a object of my choosing. And this again will make code much, much clearer, easier to understand. So very powerful stuff. And in general, I much prefer a setup where I write my Python files in a generic manner. And then configure what's happening when I run them with configuration files like these. There's really not much more to it. Maybe one quick, so if I make my evaluator, for example, this is one extra benefit of this attributes. Let's say 0.03 and then 5 folds, right? So this will an evaluator, and I can also get it as dictionary like this. This then makes it easier. So if you want to save this as a YAML, you can actually then write dump this into a YAML file if you want. So both directions are quite easy to do. So yeah, I hope you keep those in mind for any future projects that where you find like, okay, just having a script with a lot of numbers in there might not be enough. So you know, so when you write classes, think of this. This is, you know, extremely helpful. Write tests. Sometimes command line arguments is what you want. Sometimes is a configuration file is what you want. So this is a few sort of basic recommendations. And then MLflow, yeah, this is very irritating with all those warnings, but it's also, you know, once you have more than a few handfuls of models, it's so easy to lose track. It can be very good to have them in a database and be able to retrieve them. And then, you know, all these things, I could scratch only the, you know, ref, argparse, there's so much. I can only scratch the surface. The same with MLflow. It's extremely powerful. So, you know, look at them a little bit and you'll see there's a lot of stuff in there. Any questions any of these things? Because, so I think now looking at the time, we probably won't get through through everything here. So what I will talk to you about is just some basics of JSON and TinyDB, which is sort of the next step. Once YAML files are not enough anymore and you need something more powerful, then TinyDB can help you. And then I think for the next session, then we'll look at the Twitter API, because so you kind of need to do a bit of JSON because, well, the Twitter API works in JSON, but it's a, you know, Twitter as one example, there, of course, a lot of services that have APIs, which is basically a way to interact with a external service from your Python code. Or any code. So you know, APIs typically exist not only in Python, but in JavaScript and, you know, many programming languages. And you know, the Twitter API helps you to write custom Twitter programs interacting with the Twitter services. And so then next time we'll just see a little bit how you can retrieve a tweet or a list of tweets do some. So I had a master's student a while back that did some data analysis on a couple of thousand tweets that we extracted and did a bit of language analysis on. And then this is, you know, not that this is the most important API, but just to show you a little bit how you work with APIs in Python. Spoiler, it's very easy, but you know, you need to know some tricks, how to authenticate and so on. And then the last thing was a little bit of web scraping, actually. So what if you don't have an API? How can you, you know, take a web page and extract things from it that are not tables? I mean, remember when we worked with the oil spill example, we had the pandas just download a table from Wikipedia, which was super easy, but sometimes it's not that easy. So we'll talk very briefly about how to do this. And this is really more about how to get your hands on a data set when it's not readily available in CSV or in a database. Yes, but okay, so then in the last couple of minutes here, real quick, JSON. I guess most of you have heard about JSON. Has anyone not heard about JSON? No, so very easy JavaScript object notation. And this, again, helps you to, once you have something like our dictionary, and that then represents our evaluator, I can use JSON, the dump s function. So dump writes to a file, dump s writes to a string, and takes our dictionary. And this could be any Python, so any combination of lists, dictionaries, and so on. Gives you a string representation of this. So this is a string representation. And it's, YAML, JSON, very similar. YAML is a bit easier to read, a bit more powerful than JSON, but it's it parses basically to lists and dictionaries of things. And of course, you can make this look a bit nicer. The same is json.loads. Pandas. Pandas also speaks JSON. So if you have a JSON representation of a data set, which can happen quite often, and especially when you talk to APIs, very often they return some sort of data frame, and pandas can load this directly. But sometimes you want to parse this into Python objects. So the type of this will be dictionary. Right, so we go from string to a Python object. Good. Last thing. So this is a very quick intro to JSON. One very interesting and very lightweight package is TinyDB. So it behaves like a database, but by default stores a JSON file. And this can be extremely handy if you have, let's say you have, a couple of hundred parameters or so in your model, or have to store different models, and a YAML file just becomes too overwhelming, then this TinyDB with a JSON file can be really interesting. Can be an interesting alternative. So the idea is very easy. You insert objects and retrieve objects, and the objects, again, anything, any combination of dicts and lists and strings and integers is fine. So now let's say we have a database with artists' names and biographic info. So that's Lennon, first name shall be John. And then, I don't know, we want to keep track of when he was born, 1940, and Beatles, db equal tiny db. So first of all, we need to create a database, tiny db data, tinydb.json. Doesn't really matter how it's called. So here, now we have our tinydb.json, which will be in JSON format, and it will contain this one entry. So now I can make a query like so, tinydb.query. It's also very simple to use. I just say db.search. And now I can say artist dot band equal equal Beatles the probably just a typo. Right, so and here, so if I had other Beatles in here, I would get a list with all those guys. And I can do all kinds of things. I can say, okay, how many band members were there in the Beatles, by saying count. I can say, do I have any band members of the Beatles saved in my database? I can also very easily modify this. I can say db.update. So now I need to, let's say I want to update the name, which will leave all the rest in peace. Let's say I want to add a middle name, anyone? John Lennon's middle name? No, Winston, just like Churchill. And now I need to say, what record should I update? And then I can say artist.name.last equal equal Lennon. So this will be my search query, just like here. And this will be the update. So if I repeat my query here, I get the updated. So that is TinyDB. It's very minimalistic. It follows this NoSQL philosophy. So you know, the main types of databases is SQL type databases, which typically have, you know, strong guarantees, mostly are around columns and rows and you know, so very fixed structure, and the very fixed structure typically buys you speed and some operations and kind of reliability and some guarantees. While these NoSQL databases, where you can, you know, here I can just dump in anything, you know, any combination of strings and integers and dictionaries and so on works fine, which gives me less guarantee. So if I had two or three clients accessing the same file here, I might get into trouble. But it you know, gives me a lot of flexibility. And if you want to, you know, keep track of models and configuration, this can be a viable alternative. And that's not to say that, you know, all NoSQL databases are you know, toys. So certainly Amazon's DynamoDB, for example, it's a NoSQL database, which, you know, runs the Amazon website and orders and so on, and you know, can handle millions of queries per second. So they are certainly very powerful examples of NoSQL databases as well. But then, yeah, when you load your data, most of the times you will find it in a SQL type database, which you can then load into Pandas with the Pandas read SQL command. Yeah, so we're running out of time. That is what I had planned to talk about. Starting now with the whole Twitter thing, that would probably be a bit overkill. So let's take the last couple of minutes for questions and discussion, and then we take the Twitter API in the next session. Are there any questions? I actually just see now that it's actually just 11:30. So we could go a little bit into the Twitter API. Would you like to see that now, or shall we? Is it enough material? Because I know it has been a lot of different packages and Python stuff. So maybe you prefer to try some of these things out rather than seeing something new. I need, you know, at least one of you answering, because else I don't know. Okay. Yeah. Then let's see the first few steps, and then we'll take a break. So the first step is actually I need to copy some secret stuff back and forth. Good. So the first step that you need to take is you need to go to Twitter developers and sign up and, you know, get a user account there. But you know, it's your Twitter user account that you will use, and then you need to, you know, agree that you won't try to hack them or do nasty stuff. And then you'll get a bunch of secret codes, and so you need to register an app that will be able to use the Twitter API, and then you get four things. So you get an API key, an API secret key, an access token, and an access token secret, and those will be, you know, I can't show you because else you would see my secrets, and that's, you know, but it's rather straightforward how to get this from Twitter. There's a good documentation. And to access this, we need requests. And requests is a super powerful tool to talk to APIs and even do things like downloading web pages and so on. And we'll see that next time. And we need requests OAuthlib. So this zero authentication. Okay. And then I need to import my secrets. And I stored them in a Python file. So this don't hack me is just a Python file that's here. Pardon. And that contains my secret. And then this guy helps us, gives us a way to authenticate. And the first step is really to create this object. So auth equal. And you give it the API key API key secret, the access token. So all these magic constants come from don't have me. Access token and access token secret. Boom. And now the way we will talk to this Twitter API is basically we need a URL, and that really looks like, you know, it is just a URL, right? So I could copy paste this into my browser. And since I don't have the authentication, it will basically tell me, okay. And guess what? This is JSON, of course, right? So I get an error code 215, message is bad authentication data. Well, done. So I need this whole shebang. So, but the same that I did here, I can do via requests. So request sends a HTTP request and gets a response back. So now you can say verify response equal requests dot get this URL, and then I say, well, please send this authentication data. Okay, great, 200. So what does 200 mean? Well, HTTP response codes. Let's, you know, look at Wikipedia. So, okay. So the ones informal response, two is successful, great. Three, redirection, error. So 200. Great, 200, okay. Standard response for successful HTTP requests. Great, so this is very encouraging. So we got an okay request, okay response. But now actually we can look at the JSON code. So the response, it contains headers. Also here, conveniently in JSON format, which tells us a lot of stuff about the domain, when does it expire, dates, timestamps, what is sent in the body, and that brings us to the body. So there's a lot of information in those headers, and then we have a body content, and that is, you know, okay, a lot of stuff, but so this is just a binary string, but looking at this binary string, this looks a lot like JSON, right? So I can actually say response.json, and this works only for those responses where I actually get JSON. We'll see next time a response where I get just a website, right? And here now I actually get the response as a JSON, and I can, you know, now actually as a parsed JSON. So this is a dictionary. So I can now ask things like name. Well, that's of course my account, screen name, which is the handle, and so on. So there's a lot of keys in here that, you know, you can have a look at. But so let that serve as the very first introduction. So it's actually not that hard. You take a response, you take a authentication method that you initiate with the secret keys that you get from keys and the secrets that you get from Twitter, and then you can just use the requests package to retrieve those JSON documents. And really, so this looks like a document, right? It looks like verify credentials.json, like it's a document stored somewhere on the server. But actually it is generated by a computer program that sits on the other side, right? So it's just two computer programs, my Python and the Twitter API backend that talk to each other via this API, this JSON-based interface. Yes, so next time we'll go through this again and then play a little bit with the API. Any questions? No? Okay. So then let's stop the recording. And then you have the chance to ask stuff off the record.